Okay, so this morning we're getting into our final sermon in the Ten Commandments series I've been doing for almost 2 years. And we're going to wrap that up today, hopefully. And we're just going to look at the Tenth Commandment to do that. So we're looking at the commandment of do not covet. And I want to quickly just go through sort of what my approach to the Ten Commandments has been so far, in case you're new this morning, or in case you have missed a few, or you haven't heard me in a few months, because that happens. And just sort of catch up on what we're doing. So I've been looking at the Ten Commandments through the lens of a gamer, someone who enjoys board games or video games, but specifically board games. And you see, board games are really unique in this way that they basically, you get this box, and it's full of a bunch of pieces and bits and tiles and cards and meeples and all kinds of stuff like that. And you get this box of all these pieces, and you throw them out on your table. And the only way in which all those pieces come together to form a game is with the rule book. If you don't have the rule book, then all you've got is a bunch of pieces and possibly a bunch of disagreement or misunderstanding on what to do with those pieces. And it could devolve very quickly into a bunch of arguing, legalism, or debating. And so the idea of a rule book gives you definition and direction for the game to be played. And so in a similar way, the Christian life, without any form of guidance, leadership, direction, or rules, could result in all kinds of misunderstanding, false teaching, arguments, and pointless talk. And so the role of the Ten Commandments, I think, very largely, is God revealing to his chosen people the guidelines by which they are to live, in which they are to run the race laid out before them. Where are the boundaries of that race course? Where's the track? It comes to us through the Ten Commandments. They give us an outline and a direction and a purpose and a guide by which we are to be God's people, in which we are to stand out, not as just another person in the world who happens to believe in God, but as a person who lives in response to who God is. And so I've been approaching the Ten Commandments the same way I approach a rule book for a board game. And there's three ways in which we approach a rule book in a board game. And those three things are the rule as written, the rule as intended, and the rule as the errata. But before I get into that, I actually just realized my slides are going to be out of order. So I'm going to do the first slide first instead of the first slide second. We're talking today about coveting. And I looked into this. I did some research into what are the top motivations for people who commit crimes. Because I had a feeling that coveting, very conveniently, is at the very end of the commandments. And while all the other commandments that we've read so far have all been outward expressions, coveting is almost entirely inward. And so coveting actually kind of works as the errata, which we're going to get into what that means, for the whole Ten Commandments. It reminds us that it's not just about living outwardly good, but it's also inwardly. That we don't just want to seek a godliness that's external, but we want a godliness that is also internal. And so I thought, I have a feeling that the internal motivation has a part to play in the external behavior, and I have a feeling that's connected to coveting. So I did some research, and I found three very easy quotes to go with that kind of back up this idea. But there's a lot more. There is a lot more out there that support this. These are just the three I picked up. The first one is from a guy named Darren Armstrong. He's a career thief who was known for mostly for car thieving or automotive stealing. And when asked why he would steal from someone, his answer was, why should that person have nice things when I have nothing? At the time of his primary time in which he was practicing his criminal activity, he was homeless. And he would see someone drive up in a nice vehicle and park it, and the first thought he had was, why should that guy get a nice car when I have nothing even to live in? And so he would steal their car and take it. And that justified it in his mind. He desired what that person had, and why should they have something nice when I don't? Mubarak Muhammad was a gang member. His primary role as a gang member was drug dealing. And he stated that his main motivation was, I've got to get the money. I've just got to get money. The more I can gain, the happier my life will be. The last quote I came across is from one of my personal favorite movies, is Guardians of the Galaxy, which is, of course, a space movie, superheroes is not real. But Rocket Raccoon, at the end of the movie, they've the five main characters who are all kind of vagabonds have turned around, they've saved the planet, they've worked with the law, and they've become heroes. And so the local authorities have rebuilt their spaceship, and they're letting them go, and they've wiped, expunged their records for the service that they've provided. And as they're leaving, they go, "We've expunged your records, but don't commit any more crimes, or else, you know, you'll be incarcerated or whatever else." And Rocket Raccoon, great little character, he's a raccoon, and he looks up and he says, "What if I see something that I really want to take and it belongs to someone else?" And the authorities say, "Well, that's stealing and you'll be arrested." And he says, "No, you don't understand, I want it more." So as we get into the topic of coveting, we're going to discover that coveting is essentially really well pictured in those statements. Coveting is desiring that which is not your own, with no regard for the other for other people. So we're going to look at this in three ways. We're going to look at the rule as it's written. This is our time where we look at exactly what does the wording mean? What does the word coveting mean? And what are the other words in that law? And what is it really getting at? Just looking at the words. This is called exegesis is what we're going to be doing. It's pulling the meaning out of the words, pulling the meaning out of the text. So we're going to try to do that first. And then we're going to go into the rule as it's intended. This is, what was God trying to communicate to his people when he gave this law? What was God's intention for the life or the existence of his chosen people? And finally, we're going to look at the rule as errata. Errata is this really cool concept in gaming, and board gaming especially, where after years of usually internet arguments over how a rule is supposed to be used, the game maker shows up and says, "You guys all don't understand. Here's what I actually mean by this rule. Here's my actual purpose behind it. Let me reword it to make more sense." And so we're going to look at what does... So we're first looking at the wording, then we're going to look at God's intention for his chosen people, and then we're going to look at, do we have a newer revelation or a more clear understanding of this rule based on Jesus' revelation or one of the writings in the New Testament? In this case, we're going to be looking very much at Paul in 1 Timothy when we get to the errata. And so we're looking at, is there a revelation that happens later after the Ten Commandments were given that gives us a more clear understanding of this rule, where the game maker, God himself, reveals something more to us that we understand it more clearly? So we're going to do that as well today. So let's begin with the rule as it's written. The word coveting, I looked it up in the dictionary because I thought maybe I should make sure I have a dictionary definition and not just an Andrew definition. And the dictionary definition is this exact wording: to desire wrongfully, inordinately, or without due regard for the rights of others. Allow me to quickly paraphrase that for you. Coveting is to desire that which is not yours with no regard for whose it is or for any other person. It is specifically a selfish desire in which it's what I want regardless of who it belongs to or how it will affect others if I get it. In my sermon on stealing, I talked about how people have a right to own things. People have that right, and by stealing, we remove that right. And coveting basically says, I want that regardless of your rights and your opinions and how you feel about it. Coveting is selfish. It's focused on me and my desires. Like Rocket Raccoon, what if I want it more than that other person? It's about me and my desire, not about the other people. Let me just quickly read for you Exodus chapter 20, verse 17. That's where you find the Ten Commandments, in Exodus chapter 20. You'll also find them in Deuteronomy chapter 5. We're going to look in Exodus 20, verse 17. And it says this: you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his manservant or maidservant, or his donkey or his ox, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. So we've looked at what the word coveting means. It's a selfish desire. And I would suggest that this commandment actually goes into detail on three types of desires that we tend to be drawn towards as selfish desires. The first one is a desire for another person's possessions. So we see that very clearly here. Do not desire their ox or their donkey or their house or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Don't desire their possessions. It belongs to that person. They have a right to own that. It is not our place to take or desire in such a selfish way that we ignore their right. Secondly, there's a desire for another person's relationships. We are not to desire their wife or their husband or their manservant or maidservant, the people who are in their lives, who they work with, the relationships that they have. We are not to view others' relationships as something that we are to take from them or want from them. A person's relationships are what they have cultivated and worked at over time. And if you desire a relationship, you need to cultivate and work at it over time. To desire selfishly the relationship of another is wrong, according to this commandment. Finally, it's a desire for another person's social status or station. We see this one very common. We see a lot of people desiring to be in the station or social status of another person. A story about myself. A couple years back, 8 years ago, I started an internship in a church where they paid me a stipend of $500 a month. And our rent was $450. I didn't really have a lot of money. We were married. Kathleen and I were just newly married. And we weren't financially in a position where we could afford really to live the way we were living. Except that a lot of people in our church at that time who viewed my internship and my training and my education as valuable made an effort to take care of us. They provided us with food or additional funds. They gave me gift cards for fuel for my car so that I could get to and from the church. And I just had this incredible blessing given to us from the people in that church. And I can never really thank them enough for the education I received while I was interning there, as well as the support and blessing that they gave me. And yet through it, I remember very distinctly desiring to not require the gifts that they were giving me, and that I could be the one giving away things, that I could be the one financially helping somebody. I so badly wanted to not be in that social position that I was in, and I wanted to be in the position that they were in. In this commandment, where we see that is we are not to desire to be a homeowner just because someone else is a homeowner. We're not to desire their house or their wealth is also implied here in the terms of ox and donkeys. And so we need to be aware that part of the desire that comes with coveting is not just desiring possessions, but it could also be desiring relationship. It could also be desiring to have another person's life, as it were, their social status, their station, to basically live in their shoes when that's not the position we've been given or the stage that we're in. And I think oftentimes we actually hurt ourselves more than anyone when we're in that position of desire because we are failing to live in the station and the opportunity and the stage that we are in that moment because we're trying to live in something that we're not in. And God is trying to call us to live in that moment that he's given us now. And so there was nothing wrong with me desiring to one day be able to help people, and yet the selfish desire to not need others to help me and to be in that other place where I was not at. I was put in a position as an intern to learn and to be educated and to grow, and yet I so badly wanted to already be grown that I missed many opportunities to grow. And I've had to take a much harder route as a result to mature in the way that I should as a pastor. But we're getting there. So that's the rule as it's written. Three main desires: the desire for possessions, the desire for others' relationships, and the desires for social status. And these selfish desires begin to fester in our lives and eventually come out in the way that we behave and live and act. Let's go into the rule as it's intended. The rule as intended, we first have to look a little bit at context. We need to remind ourselves that the Ten Commandments were given to God's chosen people as they were becoming a nation. The Israelites had been in slavery for 400 years, and God had been mostly silent for those 400 years. And then Moses comes, and God speaks directly to Moses, reveals himself, gives him a name. I am Yahweh. I am that I am. I cause to be what I cause to be. And he chooses Moses to go and save his people and take them out of the promised, or out of Egypt and into a promised land. And on their route to that promised land, they stop at the base of the mountain, Mount Sinai, where Moses goes and he communes with God directly. And in that discussion with God, God reveals to Moses what his chosen people are to look like, what Israel as a nation is to behave like and operate as. I've talked about it a couple of years ago, I guess, when I first came here. I talked about being wow weird, that lifestyle that is God designed and God guided in such a way that the world looks at us and goes, your life is kind of weird, but not in a bad way, but kind of like in this, wow, it's weird, but I kind of want to know more about it. And through this, we have a great opportunity for evangelism in living a wow, weird, God-focused life. And any God-focused life that you have today will be wow, weird in our culture, because we live in a post-Christian culture. And so the Israelites were of the same goal. God's goal for them was to create a wow, weird nation that would exist in such a place that as people traveled from Babylon and Assyria through the promised land down to Egypt for trade to do their primary business, they would be operating, traveling through the promised land and seeing this chosen people of God living in a strange way. A people that don't worship idols. A people that don't use their Lord's name in vain. A people that worship only one God, but there's so many other gods out there. How can you only worship one? That's weird. A people that obey their parents. A people that do not lie or steal or cheat or kill the person who's in their way or upsets them. The people who do not have multiple wives and husbands, who do not commit adultery. This is a weird nation in their time period and context. And honestly, even today, many of those things would make you weird if you live by them. And so God's intention was to have a wow weird people, to have a people that lived a specific way that defined them as God's chosen people. And all of the other commandments up to this point have been mostly, I think almost entirely, outward expressions, except for maybe believe in only one God, which is the first commandment. All the rest are outward expressions of that first commandment, except for coveting. We come to coveting, and it is an inward reality. It's an inward, selfish desire. That's what coveting is. And so we're called not only to be God's people who represent him externally, but to be people whose hearts align with God's heart. That internally we are godly, not just externally. That we are an example to the people around us, not only in the way we behave, but in the way we think, in the way we process situations around us, in the way that we respond to the world, and in the way that we desire things. It's to be different. Not selfish, but God-centered. It's wow weird in the time of the Israelites. It is wow weird today. And so God's intention in this rule, I think, is most clearly seen in the context of that early nation being established. And so we see that as well for ourselves today. God desires for us to live a lifestyle that makes us stand out and defined as his people. Furthermore, this also points towards, in the Old Testament, where there was still the problem of sin. They did not yet have Jesus revealed to them. They did not yet have the Savior revealed. And I think a little bit of what happens in this law is it reveals for us a little bit to these people where sin originates. And we see this really clearly laid out by James. James is the brother of Jesus. And after Jesus ascended and the church was established in Jerusalem, Peter would go on missions trips and James was left as the head of the church. And so James, the brother of Jesus, actually became a significant member of the Christian movement and actually was the head of the church in Jerusalem for a while. And he wrote a book, a letter, to Jewish believers. So people who were of Jewish origin, who knew their Old Testament, called the Tanakh, who understood it, those people would have understood a lot of the references in the Old Testament. And so James wrote to them a letter. And he writes in the style of wisdom literature, very similar to what Solomon would have written in his wisdom books, such as the Proverbs. And he writes how we live as Christians. And I love in James chapter 1, verse 13, it's a very significant passage. It says, "When tempted, no one should say, 'God is tempting me.' For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when by his own evil desires, he is dragged away and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death." James makes it really clear. And when we look at what coveting means, that desire, selfish desire within one's own heart, that is where temptation, sin, and death comes from. God did not give this law just because he wanted the people to think differently. He desires for his people to not embrace evil desire, selfish desire, which would lead to temptation, sin, and death. This further shows God's desire not just for behavioral modification, but heart transformation. Away from a heart that desires that which is selfish and evil, towards a heart that desires what is godly, what is his kingdom, what is his purpose. A heart that desires to walk with him, not a heart that desires my own ambition. And so God desires us to practice heart transformation, not behavioral modification. The risk of us only practicing outward expressions of our belief is that we get caught up in the tradition or the ceremony or the ritualisticness. A word Chris has used is religiosity of our practice. But this commandment reminds us that it is not just about the religious outward practice. It is about the inward heart, the desire. And so we need to assess ourselves. We need to reflect on this. Are my desires for what God desires? Or are my desires for what I want? Are they selfish? Is it prideful? And I use those words very carefully because I believe that all sin is rooted in selfishness. All sin is rooted in pride. From the very first sins we see in the Bible all the way to every sin we commit today, it's any time that we place ourselves above God, created above Creator. As soon as we do that, we're in sin. So where are our desires focused? In the movie The Pursuit of Happiness, it's a great picture of what people desire from life. This is a movie about, based on a book. It's a movie about a character played by Will Smith who's basically made some bad investments and is pretty down and out. He has a kid and a wife, and they have very little money. They're hardly affording rent. They're probably back 3 or 4 months on their rent, being threatened with eviction. And so he decides he's going to try to make a change, and he pursues an opportunity at an investment firm, and they offer him an internship, and after he accepts, he finds out it's unpaid. So the whole movie is him trying to get through this internship with a chance at a job at the end that is paid while having no income. And during this process, we see a number of things happen. The wife, who cannot handle the strain, states, I just don't have any happiness. I'm unhappy. I'm out of here. And she leaves, leaving Will Smith's character and his son alone. There's a number of scenes where his son and where the two of them have to live a night in a hostel, and in one scene, even spend a night in a public washroom with a door locked. And yet the whole movie, he is driven by a desire for happiness. And as much as this movie makes us feel good, it actually really clearly represents an unhealthy and selfish desire for happiness. But I actually want to focus on a little bit different thing here. And that is what fuels that selfish desire. In this case, he was fueled by a discontent. Now, we've heard a sermon recently from Chris about being driven by a holy discontent, about an aha moment, our Popeye moment. And that's different from what I'm getting at. A holy discontent is us seeing an injustice in the world, aligning ourselves with God's goal to correct that injustice, and working with God to correct it. What I'm talking about here is someone who has a discontent with their current life situation, and in a desire to break out of our discontented situation, we pursue that which we think will fulfill us. A job that pays better, a higher social status, better possessions, better relationships. We desire that which we think is going to get us where we want to go, out of our discontentment, and when we find those things, we'll be content. I had a conversation with somebody a couple of months back. They had moved out this way, and I had asked them, hey, so why'd you move out here? And they said, I just need to get away from what was holding me back there so I can start fresh here. I went, oh, that's interesting. And unfortunately, I didn't say it in that moment, but unfortunately I watched and I knew this would happen, but all the things and problems that they had where they came from, didn't go away when they moved here. They sought to escape the discontentedness that they had in that life there. They thought that they could escape it by just going somewhere else. So they followed a desire to escape from that discontentedness, but it didn't work because when they got to a new location, the problem was still there because the problem was with the desire, the selfishness, the focus on my own desires for something different rather than on God. So transformation doesn't happen without God. In 1 Timothy chapter 6 is where I want to go for our errata, for God revealing a new reality to us. Now, I could have gone to Matthew 5 and looked at the Sermon on the Mount. It would be another very reasonable place to go, where Jesus reveals that sin, like adultery, begins with lust, which is a desire of the heart. Or murder begins with anger, hatred, which is, again, another desire or emotion of the heart. And so I could go there and talk about how Jesus reveals that basically all of the other sins, all the other commandments, are the result of a covetous heart. But I want to look at 1 Timothy 6, because here Paul is responding to a group of people in a church who were completely focused on selfish gain. And Paul corrects them and reveals to them a very significant truth. And so here's Paul writing to Timothy on how to deal with the situation in his church. He's giving a fresh teaching, something that church was not hearing yet. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 3, says this: "If anyone teaches false doctrines and does not agree to the sound instruction of our Lord Jesus Christ and to godly teaching, he is conceited and understands nothing. He has an unhealthy interest in controversies and quarrels about words that result in envy, strife, and malicious talk, evil suspicions, and constant friction between men of corrupt mind who have been robbed of the truth and who think that godliness is a means to financial gain. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. People who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people, eager for money, have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs." I love this passage because it is so pointed at today. It was so relevant in that situation for Timothy in that church, but it is so relevant for us today in North America because we live in a capitalist culture which is very much focused on the gaining of wealth. But it also speaks very clearly to the topic of what we desire and our selfish desires. Even if we took the idea of finances out of this passage, there are those who see godliness as an opportunity to gain. That if they outwardly express godliness, that it will fulfill my inward desire that is selfish, focused on me. We have a selfish desire for personal gain, and many of us think that if we at least practice the good moral teachings, that we'll experience that personal satisfaction. And that maybe that will draw us out of our discontentment into a contented life. That'll draw us out of our depression into happiness and bliss. That if we would just live the right morals, maybe we'll get where we want to go. And it focuses on the external, but never addresses the internal. So Paul lays that out really clearly in verses 3 through 5. And I had to read it all together because it's basically one sentence. There's like only one period in all of that four verses. So very important to read that all as one section because it was meant to be one section. But then he switches it on its head. There's this evil desire that draws people to pursue personal gain, and often they do that through godliness. Then let's switch it on its head. But it's godliness with contentment that's truly gain. And he's not talking about finances. He's not talking about social status or relationships. He's talking about the experience that we have with Jesus. He's talking about heart transformation. This contrast is significant. And then he goes on to clarify, if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. I wonder, honestly, if how many of us could honestly say we'd be content with only food and clothing. I personally have wrestled with that. When I was being hired here at Brightview, they asked me what I expected in terms of salary. And I remember saying, and then wondering if I was honest when I said it, saying, it doesn't matter how much you pay me. Make sure that my family's taken care of and that we've got food on our table. It's all I care about. And I said that, and yet I found myself wondering, did I mean it? I hope I did. I hope I did. But I wonder how many of us might say that, but do we really believe it? Do we really mean it? I don't know if every day that I would mean that. I think some days I do, and some days I definitely struggle with that. For many of us, we would not be content there. And so what is Paul getting at? He's calling us to find contentment not in what we have, or in the people around us, or in anything that could ever diminish over time. He's calling us to find contentment in who it is that makes us who we are. And who I am is found in who God is. It says, God said, I created you in my own image. It says this in Genesis chapter 2. We created man in my own image, in our own image is actually what it says there. And so we are created in the image of God, and who we are is defined by the one who creates us, by the one whose image we are made in. And we're called by Paul in this chapter to find contentment in that knowledge, and knowing who it was that made us, and knowing who it is that defines us and identifies us. To not find contentment in the stuff that we have or don't have, but to find contentment in who God is. We see Paul elaborate on this a bit in verse 17, if we skip ahead a bit there, to chapter 6, verse 17. He says, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. We are to find contentment in God. We're to look inside and look at our heart and say, am I desiring selfishly for things I want? Or am I just aligned with God? Am I just in love with Him? And can I find contentment in who He is and who He has made me to be? And when I find that contentment combined with that godliness, that is when my life becomes a life that is full. John 10:10. Jesus said, I've come to give you a life and a life to the full. And I think the point the way in which we discover that is found here in godliness and contentedness. So today has been a call to address the selfish desires of our hearts, to identify them, name them, call them out, and then practice a heart transformation. Not a behavioral modification, but a heart transformation where we choose to find contentment in the relationship that we already have with God, to find contentment in the one who identifies us as His people, who has called us to live a wild, weird life because He chose us, because He made us. Find contentment in that and find the fullness that comes in that relationship. So today is a call to find contentment in the relationship you have with Christ. Let's close in prayer. We'll have the music team come back up. Dear Jesus, thank you for your word. Thank you, Lord, that you desire for us to not only change the way we live externally, but that you want to work within our hearts to change us internally. That you know all things about all people, and you know the hearts of men, like David, whose heart sought after you. Lord, help us to have a heart that seeks after you, and not after our own desires. Help our desire to align with your desire, to see the world transformed, to see your kingdom grown. And Lord, I pray that you would help us in that to find contentment in who you are and what you are doing in this world. And through that contentment, Lord, we know you will bring us great fulfillment in the knowledge that you've given us. Lord, help us to submit to that, and to submit to you, and to surrender our desires. Praise in your name, Lord. Amen.